Today's date is the 29th of April, 2008. There's a lot happening in the sky. So Mercury moved, Venus moved, Mars moved. Mars moved into Cancer, finally out of Gemini. Mars had been in Gemini for months and months and months. Normally, Mars would enter a sign and remain there for about a month. Mars has now moved forward into Cancer as of yesterday. And Mars is debilitated in Cancer. It's weak place, its weak spot. And Mars is going to be in Cancer, I believe, until the 21st of June. So it's not a month, it's about a month and 3 weeks, almost 2 months long. Mars in Cancer creates the following: short tempers, frustration, anger, resentment, degrees of danger, recklessness, carelessness, accusations, conflicts, eruptions between people, threats, fighting. Lawsuits.
Is it worse if you have got
more? Well, that's the negative side. I'm sort of giving you the negative side of it. It can create emotional overreaction, blame, criticism, I said, and people blowing up very, very easily, very quickly, over nothing. Now, this may be people, it may be you, it may be somebody next to you, close to you. So, be careful. Be careful. Practice patience, tolerance, acceptance, forbearance, understanding, biting your tongue. Because this is a more volatile time. The positive sign of Mars in Cancer is, even though it's debilitated there, it tends to perform fairly well when it comes to energy and action and assertiveness and daring, depending where it is in a person's chart. But a lot can get accomplished. You see, the problem is we've got a fire planet, Mars, in a water sign, Cancer. You know, fire and water, they don't really mix. It's like you've got the masculine planet in the feminine sign. They don't necessarily work.
So it makes no difference if your Mars is exalted?
No, it doesn't. The way it works for that is, where does it end up in your chart overall? So you can look at where it is from your ascendant. You can look at where it is from your moon. You can look at where it is from your sun. You can look at where it is from your Mars. And we can say different things about each. You know, I mean, this astrology is so comprehensive and so expansive that you could look at any planet from any circumstance, any situation, and go on and on and on about it. And you'll find truth. You'll find knowledge. Because everything's connected. You know, for years I used to teach astrology in Los Angeles, actually up in Hollywood, and plus a lot of other places. But I used to do that regularly. And, you know, I found with students that no matter how much you know about astrology, somebody will say, well, could this mean this then? What you're saying, could that mean that? Could that mean that? Would that be the result? And, of course, absolutely. Now, things that I would never think of. because you can't think of everything. It's just too much. You can't see a circumstance from every conceivable perspective. One person cannot do that. Not possible. So somebody who's just starting out, there's a wonderful insight that's just been given. You know, that person can see or sees it in a certain way. So anything is possible. For you, Mars in Cancer is directly opposite. Because if your Mars is exalted in Capricorn, then Mars in Cancer is the opposite. So it's directly opposite, 180 degrees. That means it's debilitated. So Mars are these two Mars positions are opposing each other. That what I said initially about Mars creates it even more so. More difficulty or more opposition can happen. Now that doesn't mean you have that from everybody, but it'll turn up. You can bet, you know, it'll turn up.
Can someone still go forward, like if somebody has a proposal for an idea, like creative, can you
explain? Oh, sure.
So just within
Yeah, I mean, it's Mars is, it's good for going forward with things. It's good for taking action. Just be careful that you don't rub people the wrong way, you know, or they don't rub you the wrong way. Yeah, well, then you're going to you may well experience that a little bit more, you know. Where's your Mars? I don't remember. You have Mars on the ascendant. You have Mars rising. So does she. Yeah, it can be good. It can be good. Depends. Any experiences? Mantra. Any spiritual experiences? Any good meditations? Dreams? Anything that the rest of us might benefit from hearing?
I've done a lot of Rama and Lakshmi, but I've noticed that my mind has totally settled. There's definitely more of a quietness, and I don't know whether that's because of it or not, but it does feel like now I'm constantly like doing Rama and Krishna. It's like as if my mind's kind of gone on a little holiday. It's great. negativity or criticism. Like the criticism or the negativity, it's just gone. And then with Lakshmi, just the little things like a job I did, they needed me to do it again a week, and I only took 5 minutes the second time, it was twice, and checks coming in.
Excellent.
Yeah, cool. For Lakshmi.
Dave Yai. Well, I mean, there's no big problem, but you know, now you can correct it. Dave Yai. Which one is it? Om Shri Dev Yai Namaha. Dev Yai.
And the Krishna was amazing.
Very, very serious mantra. Yeah, that mantra is highly powerful and highly effective. When you're chanting a mantra, you are associating directly with the gods, whether you realize it or not. Here in the material world, if you're sitting there with somebody and you mention a third person's name, John, and you both know John, so you mention John, now a flood of recognition and experience and history and things about John, connected to John, will come into your mind. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly his face, what he looks like, and so many things will come into your mind, and things that you both recognize about John. But John's form, his body, and his name are two different things, obviously. And by saying John, the most we're going to get out of that is a memory. Maybe a positive memory, maybe a negative memory, maybe a neutral one. But that's all we're going to get. Whereas, when you're dealing with the gods are not on a relative plane. Everything down here is relative. The gods are on an absolute plane. It's transcendental to the material creation. It's beyond. So, especially God himself, such as Krishna, his name, form, qualities, pastimes, everything to do with them is on the exact same plane. One thing is not less than the other. So when you're saying the name of a god or goddess, you're actually, if you could see with divine eyes, you would see them right there. They're there. As I'm speaking about them now, they're here. Whether you can see them or not, okay. But they're here. Believe me. And the more you chant, but you chant with faith. And even if you don't have faith and belief to begin with, that's fine. The chanting will bring that to you. You'll have experiences. It'll open your heart. It'll open your mind. You'll have revelation. You'll have realization. You'll have inner peace. You'll begin to rise above all of the tribulation that is down here. We human beings tend to live our lives horizontally. Everything down here I'm referring to as horizontal living. Horizontal living experience. And it all happens down on this linear plane. When you begin to bring spirit and God and divinity into your life, now it becomes vertical and horizontal. So this brings in the spiritual element to intersect the mundane, horizontal, routine, day-to-day experience that, believe it or not, drains you more than anything else. And eventually, it kills you off. Gravity pulls you down and pulls you down and pulls you down until you end up in a grave. This is a fact. So when you can bring in the vertical experience, what's this? That's the sacred symbol. That's the cross. That's the vertical intersecting the horizontal spirit and matter. Right? So then everything becomes more enriched and more vital and more alive, and one can begin to lift beyond all this nonsense that's down here. And believe me, there's a lot of nonsense here. There's a lot of nonsense in your head. A whole lot of nonsense in your head, no offense. And because there's a whole lot of nonsense here. Because people are focused on the wrong thing. And then they easily end or slip into fear. Easily. So when you start chanting, you associate with God or the goddess directly. Whether you realize it or not, it's direct association. It's not just a name. It's not just a sound. It's direct association with that divinity, with that personality, with that energy. Direct. And that starts to have an effect on you.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
You know, when a person goes through trauma and they work through it and they go beyond it, and then a while later, say maybe a couple of years, even though they've dealt with that trauma and something else happens, a different trauma, the other stuff comes back into the situation. It's like the whole thing is...
Then they haven't dealt with it.
They haven't dealt with it.
No. Dealt with it means you've resolved the conflict attached to it, or that it generated when the thing occurred. Yeah. For example, it could be anything. Let's say sexual abuse, which is, you know, fairly common enough. I'll say to somebody, well, I see there's sexual abuse, and they'll say, yeah, there was this or that. And then I'll say, and have you dealt with that? And they'll say yes or no, depending. And sometimes they'll say yes. So yes means that whatever hurt or emotional damage or reactive circumstance, anger, hurt, frustration, embarrassment, shame, of course, is a big one, that it created, that no longer has an effect. No longer has an effect. You have to get to the place of neutrality. You don't have to, whoever this person is, more often than not, it's a family member. You don't have to love that person any longer. You say, well, I could never love that person. Well, yeah, of course you can't. So you don't have to love them, but you have to come to a place of neutrality. You cannot continue to hate them. You can avoid them, that's fine. But you have to genuinely come to a place of neutrality. So when you think of the circumstance, they did this and this to me, it doesn't have an effect. There is nothing attached to it emotionally. And when you think of that person, there's nothing attached. And when you see that person, there's nothing attached to it. Now, you may not want to spend time and speak with them. Perfectly understandable. In fact, why should you? But if anything is triggered, it has not been dealt with.
Okay.
You know, it may have been dealt with to a certain extent.
There's so many different hidden layers to something. It makes them a process. You've dealt with something and then another aspect of it pops up.
Yeah, well, it's...
That's the way with everything, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but... You know, if you think of anybody, you think somebody right now in your mind who you had a conflict with earlier on in your life, who really made you angry or really hurt you, whatever, and you say that you've gone past that or you took steps to get past that in the past. Now we bring them into your mind right now. Go do it. Is there any emotional reaction to it? If there's any kind of negative emotional reaction, it has not been fully and completely released. It's that simple.
Yeah, I would agree with that, I think. But I think as well that there are different layers.
Well, there are different layers. Now, like I say, you don't want to put yourself back in harm's way or...
Maybe that you see things differently.
Where you're reacting.
You know, years later.
Yeah.
You don't react either, but the pain gets deeper
or
something.
It's still there.
It touches much deeper or something like that.
This is 6 years ago, something really awful happened to me, and I lost my business, everything. But I mean, I did get back because I really fought really hard. But I actually lost 3/4 of my business because of it. And it's after taking me a few years to get it back. You know, almost where it was.
You have to look at, in a situation like that, you have to look at self-sabotage and how you're you've drawn a similar situation to yourself twice. And it's serious enough if you lose your business, your customers or clients, and or your livelihood. That's serious. It's not serious. But you have created your own reality. So on that level too, you must take responsibility for why or how did you create this. You might, I agree with you, it doesn't sound fair with what they did and how they handled it. I agree. But how is it that you're attracting that kind of unfairness into your life? You also have to look at it from that point of view.
I think the blessing in the whole thing was that I had the strength to fight them, and I won.
Well, maybe that's...
So that might be the thing that changes it all around.
What you needed is to stand up.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you just keep getting boxed until eventually you decide, okay, I'll get up and I'll fight, I'll finish this off, and then that thing's never attracted to you again.
Yeah, sometimes.
It's like abuse, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's abuse, and you have to stand up for yourself.
Only the thing with something like that is it just comes out of the blue and it's attacking your business, where you think, you know, where did this come from? You don't. It's hard to find all these underlying things. That's the difficult part, is trying to find out where it's actually coming from.
I was going to, still in response to your statement, Eve, about the mind being affected. A person must elevate himself by his own mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. So, purport. The word Atma denotes body or mind or soul, depending on different circumstances. In the yoga system, the mind and the conditioned soul are especially important. Since the mind is the central point of yoga practice, Atma refers here to the mind. The purpose of the yoga system is to control the mind. Period. The purpose of the yoga system is to control the mind. So this is what you're giving examples of in your chanting. That it is far easier for you to control your mind because you're chanting these very potent mantras on a regular basis. Make sense? The purpose of the yoga system is to control the mind and to draw it away from attachment to sense objects. It is stressed herein that the mind must be so trained that it can deliver the conditioned soul from the mire of ignorance. You have to train the mind to see through things, to see the truth, to recognize what is true and not get carried away by a flood of ignorance. In material existence, one is subjected to the influence of the mind and the senses. In fact, the pure soul is entangled in the material world because of the mind's ego, who desires to lord it over material nature. So the mind always tries to lord it over. We're here because we want to lord it over. Meaning, our mistake was we thought we were the center of the universe and everything revolved around us. If there's any such thing as original sin, that's it. That's what original sin is in a nutshell. It's what was your first mistake? That's your first mistake.
I don't remember making
that mistake. No, well, we don't remember many things. Well, you're here nonetheless, aren't you?
they can't just accept an apology and you get back in.
Therefore, the mind should be trained so that it will not be attracted by the glitter of material nature. And in this way, the conditioned soul may be saved. Or saved from what? Suffering in repeated birth and death. One should not degrade oneself by attraction to sense objects. I know, it's easier said than done. The more one is attached by sense objects, the more one becomes entangled in material existence. The best way to disentangle oneself is to always engage the mind in God consciousness. There has to be some degree of enjoyment in the material world because we do have senses after all. Unless you're a really, really advanced and elevated soul who doesn't need to have any kind of enjoyment, but that wouldn't be the majority of people. So we will be indulging ourselves, at least to some extent, from time to time. But we must not become attached.
Meaning identify with the stuff, you know?
Correct. Correct.
And need it.
Yeah, well, we become addicted.
If you really want something, not to have it.
That's what you want to do. If you want to do, we talk many times about undertaking a vow. So we've talked about, say you're going to chant one round on the mala of a particular mantra every day. That's a vrata, for example. What are you really attached to? Are you really attached to coffee? Well, let's give up coffee for a week. For a month. Are you attached to alcohol? Let's give up alcohol. Are you attached to sex? Let's give up sex. What are you really attached to? Get yourself to give it up for a period of time. If you're so attached to it you can't even stand how much you're attached to it, then just make it a week and see what happens. Train yourself to let go, to detach. This is of great, great value. Do not forget, at the point of death, it'll all flood in at once. All of the attachments at once. You'll be tested on immediately. So, a chocolate bar. So you want
people come into it as well, Jerry, don't they?
Pardon?
People come into it as well.
Oh yeah. Of course. People. Loved ones. You know, it's hard to love somebody and not be attached to them. It's very hard. How do you do it? It's very hard. There's a story of this sage called Bharat, and he became a realized soul. He underwent penances, austerities, meditation, vows for like 1,000 years, something like this. It would have been like one of the longer yugas, golden age or silver age, bronze age maybe. And he became fully God conscious. And he was just to remain in that state until it was time for him to give up his body. And at that time, he was told that his soul would return to the spiritual world. So he would be liberated from repeated birth and death. So he was living in an ashram, a hermitage in the forest, next to a river, which they would do. In fact, they still do in India. And they live a very simple life. And some of them eat roots and fruits. Or some of them might grow a veggie garden, but they live. Some of them might live on water or on air, as we've discussed in the past. Anyway, he was living this kind of a life, very simple, and engaged in hours and hours of meditation on a daily basis. This is a highly elevated soul. Didn't need the comforts. Wouldn't have had a sitting room like this one. And a fawn, a little baby deer whose parents had been killed by hunters, was wandering alone in the forest. So the sage, of course, had compassion for the little deer and began to care for it and give it water and food and look after it, because it had no one. It would have perished. It was too small without some care. And he nursed and nurtured this fawn into adulthood. So naturally the fawn became very attached to him, and he to the fawn. He was still very God conscious, except for one thing. His attachment to this deer. So at the point of death, what do you think happened? What was on his mind at the point of death? And the thought was what? What is going to happen to this deer without me around to look after it? That was the thought. Which is a thought for the deer, not even himself. You know, you could say, well, that's a very compassionate thought. And so the last thing on his mind was what? A deer and not God. So guess what happened? He came back as a deer, in a deer body. But because he was such an elevated soul, he came back with full consciousness. His full, what his mind, exactly what his mind was capable of at in his last life at death, he had that. He was no deer. He was a highly evolved sage running around acting like a deer in a deer's body.
Deer to God.
Deer to God. Exactly. I'm not sure if he had an antenna. He may have had an antler, but so that's what happened to this soul. And no offense here, but this, he'd be a little more advanced than you and me.
So,
or at least me.
If you were really attached, like, let's say, I would really fear for my son. Like,
yeah, well, it doesn't mean you're going to take birth as your son. Well, then you may enter into another relationship with your son in the next lifetime. A different kind of relationship. The two of you may be there together again.
So many people end up coming back.
Yeah,
around the same people over and over again.
Same people, yeah.
I see.
You're actually better off just saying, you know, look after Jesse and then focus.
Yeah, you do not want, you know, I'm going to miss smoking my cigars. Mm. Or, you know, whatever it might be. Mm. You do not want to be in that consciousness. And the other thing, if I may, it's not like it is at death. It's not like it is right here at this, right this minute. We're all sitting around. You know, it's comfortable. We're not in pain. We have our wits about us. You know, Everybody who's been reasonably fed before they came, everything's fine. You know, nobody's suffering pain, I don't think. Death is quite the opposite. Your senses start to fail, and you can't hear, and you can't see, and you can't think, and the machine stops working. That's what that's like. It's much, much harder than you think it's going to be. Oh, it's absolutely so difficult.
I know,
pain wipes out everything.
Well, that guy was so highly developed, you know, in the God conscious, that he fell into that trap of being attached to a deer.
Correct.
So what happened there?
Is it that they wanted so much to stay here, to keep evolving out here?
No, he over-identified himself, didn't he?
Yeah,
he was a helpless creature.
Yeah, he was too compassionate or overly compassionate. You know, evolved souls tend to be very compassionate and kind and helpful. But he ended up being overly compassionate and fell. I mean, you know what people are like. Oh, a little baby anything. A little baby deer, you know, he comes on the screen at the movie and everybody goes, oh, collective sigh, you know, and everybody does that, you know, except the ones that look at everybody and go, the detached one. Yeah.
You have to find the right thing that you're attached.
Yeah, well, I'm 50-50. I can be very detached and less detached at times. So, yes. Attached to the senses. I was going to read a couple things from the Bhagavad Gita. Nirmana moha jitta sanga dosha adhyatva nitya vinivritta kama dvandvair vimukta sukha dukkha sangyair gachant yamudha padam avyayam tat. This is the 15th chapter. One who is free from illusion, false prestige, and false association, who understands the eternal, who is done with material lust, and is freed from the duality of happiness and distress, and who knows how to surrender unto the Supreme Person, attains to the eternal kingdom or the eternal world. Purport. The surrendering process is described here very nicely. The first qualification is that one should not be deluded by pride. Because the conditioned soul is puffed up, thinking himself the lord of material nature, it is very difficult for him to surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should know by the cultivation of real knowledge that he is not the Lord of material nature. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the Lord. When one is free from delusion caused by pride, he can begin the process of surrender. For one who is always expecting some honor in this material world, it is not possible to surrender to the Supreme Person. Pride is due to illusion. For although one comes here, stays for a brief time, and then goes away, he still has the foolish notion that he's the Lord of this world. He thus makes all things complicated and is always in trouble. The whole world moves under this impression. People are considering that the land, this earth, belongs to human society. And they have divided the land under the false impression that they are the proprietors. And so they divide small pieces of land. They call it my field. They divide bigger pieces of land. They call it my county, County Wicklow. They divide larger pieces of land. They call it my city. Larger pieces of land, they call it my country. And so on. These are arbitrary divisions. And if you cross over this imaginary line, I'll have you in court. Even your famous guy here, Pat Kenny, was in court recently fighting over, I couldn't quite figure it out, a piece of land across the street from the two next door neighbors fighting over a piece of land across the road. Anyway, so that's what happens, you know. Your fence is 2 inches over on my side. Tear it down and rebuild it on your own side. Has this ever happened? Oh, yes. Yeah. When one is freed from such a false notion of proprietorship, he becomes freed from all the false associations caused by familial, social, and national affections. These false associations bind one to the material world. After this stage, one has to develop spiritual knowledge. One has to cultivate knowledge of what is actually his own and what is actually not his own. And when one has an understanding of things as they are, he becomes free from all the dual conceptions such as happiness and distress, pleasure and pain. He becomes full in knowledge. Then it is possible for him to surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just before you came, there was a person describing being with her family over the weekend or the past week. I don't recall. And all of these associations of loving bonds to the family, it was such a difficult chore and a conflict and all these sub themes running, you know, contrary as they do, that when all was said and done, she went back to her home and collapsed out of sheer fatigue from having spent this wonderful time at a family reunion. You see the duality here? People always want to, well, I say it too generally, but people, they always look forward to these great family reunions where we're all going to get together. In America, it's the whole Thanksgiving thing, because that's when people are really, they really get together and have this big dinner, and all of their psychosis and neurosis and codependency and all their nonsense comes up to the surface. You know, so what's the big reward ultimately? You know, sometimes there are loving relationships, genuine loving relationships. A lot of times we're just keeping up appearances. And we're attached to being attached. Now, I want to just say something about this one statement in here. It says, who is done with material lust and is freed from the duality of happiness and distress. Lust is fire. It's the fire element that burns. And you know what it's like when people, I mean, I'm talking about sexual lust now. There's different kinds of lust. You can lust after all kinds of things. but I'm referring to sexual lust. Maybe all lust would come under the element of fire. Lust burns as sexual desire burns. It's like a fire, a fever. How many songs have been written about you set me on fire, you give me the fever, and off we go, you know, take a Panadol or whatever, you know. So it's a fact. That's what happens. And as you get older, this is more true for men than it is for women. As you get older, you start losing your senses. Meaning, your senses don't work as well. Your eyes don't work as well. Your hearing doesn't work as well. All kinds of stuff doesn't work. Your hair falls out. This is the fire, that same fire element, that was contributing to your vitality, and your life force has been spent or used up by too much indulgence in the fire of lust. So instead of it having a...
Does that mean you're blind?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you're not dying, you're not
going to
lose your hair, and you won't go deaf.
Yeah, well, you will have more of the life force, or this fire.
Well, look at the nuns. How many
vitality.
Nuns are all living in their 90s, and they're
just... I find it's all dead. It's like as if fire has gone since I was... like 1920, where I was always, I never think about it, because that's what I think I should be.
Yeah, but you're not, that's not what most people do. That's fine, but that's not what most people do. And men especially. So I'm just saying, people don't realize that this lust burns up the vital force. That's my point.
Yeah, and people are too often told that, you know, your relationship, to keep it healthy, you need to...
Yeah, you mean you're not bonking all the time?
Yeah. You know,
well, if you're not bonking all the time, you need to see a counselor. You need to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, because you've got real problems in your relationship.
If you're what all the time?
Bonking.
If you're not.
If you're not having sex regularly, then you need counseling. Oh. That's just assumed to be correct. It's correct on this level. This is one level. It's correct if you're in the mode of passion. If you're in rajas, that makes complete sense. When you lift your consciousness up to the mode of goodness, to sattva, then you see that's not as important. Just as we talked earlier, the more you chant, these things that your mind was concerned with and preoccupied with now don't seem so important any longer, because your consciousness is being raised. Whatever, whenever, however you raise your consciousness, things that were important or preoccupied your mind begin to diminish in importance. Anyway, so I was just saying.
Well, that fire can be used differently anyway.
Correct.
Channel it in.
Creative fire.
Yeah.
Libido.
Yeah, you've just...
Libido, everybody thinks libido is sex drive. Mm. Well, on this level it is. Mm. If you're talking about second chakra, libido is sex drive. Well, let's go make babies. Better yet, let's not make babies. Let's just have sex. And then, you know, we'll spend the libido. Libido simply means creative energy, creative potency. So it can be sublimated and raised up and spent or used in other ways, like putting pink paint on canvas.
I think probably through where libido sticks in one area, it's like addiction forms. because your needs haven't been met, mm-hmm. and you know that tends to be with sex addictions and alcoholism and gambling and all that stuff.
Yeah, but that's more, yeah, that's an emotional lack, imbalance.
It's an attention thing. It's yeah. not loved unless they get that. Yeah. They confuse the two.
Yeah, that's true. But men are still, men are kind of wired for that anyway. You know, men think about sex constantly. I mean, almost all the time. It's a fact.
It's, yeah, actually the...
Except as they get older, then.
A gay friend of mine told me that, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why the gay scene, you know, that's disease spread so fast, you know, because they have to have it all the time. It's on the mind of it.
Oh, yeah. No,
They think about
sex. Yeah, men would think about sex once every minute, once every 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, that's
why porn is the most biggest industry in the world.
Yeah.
Which one? That's
porn is the biggest industry in the world.
So you said porn.
Yeah.
That's who.
That's right. Porn is the big industry. That's why. I mean, men can be like focused on the task at hand, doing the job, right? At the office, sitting in front of the computer or at the desk doing the work, and then she walks by. Oh my God! Look at her today. You know,
they're easily distracted.
Oh, easily.
Oh my God.
You know, it's almost if you could hear the dialogue in the guy's head.
Yeah. What women think or what women want.
Oh yeah, yeah,
like
yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, I saw that last week actually.
So what's really,
yeah.
So what's really great is that man who's transcended that so that he doesn't get distracted by a woman
as much.
So it's really
what to speak of at all. Yeah. For a man to genuinely have transcended his, I don't mean that he's going around actually having a physical connection with women. I mean that his mind is just even going there. Even though he doesn't do it, he keeps thinking about it. But beyond that, where his mind doesn't go there any longer, and he sees a woman and he's not lusting after.
Well, maybe he's loving them more.
Well, yeah.
I mean, yeah. If he transcends. I know Barry Long always talks about it. He goes, he stopped lusting after woman and love woman.
Yeah.
And dissecting that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can be with her with that. Because one of the guys, the seminar thing I have, and one guy puts up his hand, he goes, and he was quite young, and he goes, but I keep lusting after, I keep wanting her. And he's like, well, can you get rid of the want and just be with her and love her and be in the moment? He's like, no.
But so it's a real miracle, like people who...
Yeah.
Oh,
like
no.
Men who
it's a big thing.
30 years and never really look left or right. I mean, is it a miracle?
Is there a chance you could do to invite that man into like, no, I'd like to be with.
Or are they the switched off ones who just...
Well, you see, it depends. It depends, you know. There's a thousand reasons. It depends. But it is a very elevated state, and it's a very difficult state to attain.
So do we have to, as women, have to be at that stage in the tribe?
Women have to be at the state where they too are not attached to those physical needs, and their focus is on God. But as I've read to you in the past, or discussed with you, in Vedic culture, a woman is always supposed to be taken care of and looked after. And protected, always. Protected, but out of love, not out of manipulation, not like you sometimes hear it with some people or some cultures, like the Muslim culture is an example, in my opinion, I'm generalizing, a very manipulative treatment of women in the name of protecting her.
Yeah.
You know, but they're denying her her individuality and every kind of right imaginable, and they want to keep her down, and they don't want to let her study or fulfill herself as a person. That's not what we're talking about as protection. That's not the example. But that she's loved and protected, and in a circumstance like that, the woman's focus is supposed to be on her husband. We read that about Sita and Ram on that Sunday when you were here. And this is also her salvation. And so if her husband is a God-conscious soul and she's sharing that with him, you know, she's more or less walking the path with him. So whatever he gains, she will gain by virtue of being a loving wife. I mean, it even said that even if the guy's kind of a jerk, she's still supposed to, you know, whether you agree with it or not, she's still supposed to be loyal and devoted to him. But that aside, a woman also must become detached. Yeah.
So how does a single woman then prepare for that? Do you still make all the things to do about God then?
Yeah. Yeah, you make God the center of your life. Instead of doing things for yourself, anything you want to do for you is ego. Anything comes from ego. Anything you do for anybody else, you might argue, it doesn't come from ego, but it still has karmic result. Anything you do for yourself will have, it comes from ego and has a karmic result, karmic reaction. Anything you do for others, also has a karmic result. May or may not come from ego, depending. But it too would have a karmic result. The only thing you can do that does not generate karma, positive or negative karma, is to act for God's pleasure.
Yeah, and expecting nothing in return for what you do.
Correct.
Yeah.
So because in the spiritual world, God is the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody acts for God's pleasure. It's not torture.
You mean like chanting?
Chanting, and out of love, out of joy. Yeah, chanting is a sacrifice.
And then in a relationship, you would still keep that focus.
Yeah.
So when you say the devoted wife, would you be first devoted to God and then the husband, or would you make the husband your...
Well, it would run kind of simultaneous. You know, it gets into a difficult area. If your husband is very God conscious, then it's easier to devote yourself to your husband and God. But if your husband's not God conscious, and in fact he's against you wasting your time chanting
and in these other yugas when the Vedas were passed and you had more conscious men.
Exactly. This is the Iron Age. This is Kali Yuga. We've talked about it numerous times.
So there's far more Muppets at the moment.
There's far more Muppets running around, as my wife likes to say. And Muppets, she refers to men. Well, you can see what she means. We don't have to explain.
No offense to the Muppets.
No offense to the Muppets.
There's also a lot of good guys. Like,
yeah, there are a lot. Yeah.
A lot of good guys?
Yeah, they're just very hard to find.
Some of them do come to your meditation.
You put God at the center. See, the point is this. Anything we focus on here in the material world, things or people, it's temporary. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. All of it. So it will run its course. It will come to an end. Why do you want to focus on something that will come to an end? Because when it ends, guaranteed, you will suffer. You will grieve. If you focus on your eternal nature, your divine nature, which is your spiritual nature, the soul, the soul's relationship with the super soul, God in the heart, that will never end. Death will not take it away from you. It'll continue. You need, if indeed you are taking birth lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, you need the thread. You need to have the thread that runs through it all. And that thread is spiritual consciousness. The rest of it is beginning, middle, and end, over and over and over again. And ultimately, you get defeated each and every time. And then you come back again, and you forget. According to the Vedas, when the little soul becomes conscious in the womb, it prays fervently, "Oh my God, I know I really messed up last time, but this time I'm really going to focus on you, and I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to solve this riddle, this puzzle. I'm going to get, I promise. I'm not going to come in. Oh, this womb is so uncomfortable." You know, they're stuck in this womb. And then out it comes, squeeze your head down the old birth canal. Forget everything you said. You know?
The Jewish story and Jewish religion, and it goes like this. Before a baby is born, it knows everything. It's with God. When the baby is born, it's hit on the head and forgets everything. And the purpose of its life is to remember everything that it forgot.
Correct. That's it.
The baby here yesterday, 5 weeks old. And I was saying to the dad, I said, the poor little guy, you know, he's in the dining room. You know, and he's just stuck there, you know. He opens his eyes and goes back to sleep and poos on himself. And I'm the poor little fucker. He goes through it all over again.
Yeah, you know? See, we all look at babies. We all look. Oh, so sweet. Oh, so cute. Oh, how old is he? Oh, and he's doing this now, and he's doing that. Oh. That is a miserable condition to be a baby. It's absolutely miserable. You have no control over anything.
You can't tell what's going on with you.
No.
You can't.
You poo on yourself every time.
Totally helpless. To cry for everything that's going on.
You can't walk.
Like a baby.
What if you're born in a family of completely dependent? And, you know, my parents, I remember when I was a little guy, my parents would fight, and they would fight, you know. And one time I got so, my dad threw an ashtray at my mother, and it hit the wall. It didn't hit her. It smashed. It was glass. I said, "That's it. I can't take it anymore. I got to get the hell out of here." I did. And I went and got my jacket. And I walked out. I mean, it's maybe 12 years old, yeah? Well, where am I going to go? You know? What have I got? Maybe 50 cents in my pocket. And I'm off, you know? And I get out the back door. I go around to go around the gate, through the gate, out of the yard. And who tears out of the house behind me but my mother? There's no other children. There's just me and those two. And my mother goes, where are you going? I said, "I can't stand it anymore. I got to get out of here. I can't stand the way you two carry on." "Okay, I'll go with you." "Come with me. I want to get away from you. Don't you understand?" It's like, "What's going to happen to me?" "I don't know. You're married. Him and you. It's got nothing to do with me." I'm trying to explain it. You know, I've got 10 feet. And then I went back in the house because I had no options.
She was going to torture you inside.
Oh, she was, yeah, whatever. You know, I still, even if she would have stayed home and I would have gone, where would I have gone? What could I do? You have no choice. You're stuck. You know, and many women, not just women, men too, but mostly women, be in relationship for 20 years. And where are they going to go? They don't want to be there anymore. They don't want to live with your man any longer. Where are they going to go? It's very difficult. So the material world has these snares, these traps, these webs at every turn. You know. So when is it enough? You have to ask yourself, when have I had
enough?
No, you see, even when it's an easy life, it's not an easy life. You know, look at us. We're doing very well, karmically speaking. We sit here, we're bathed, we're clean, we have nice clothing, we have nice food. You know, we live in a very, very well-off country here, in spite of whatever's going on. But how many, what were you telling me today? How many people now, it's becoming a food shortage.
No, it's not. Well,
yeah. Through the world, it's becoming a food shortage. So did you miss a meal today?
No.
No. Did you? No. Did you? Unless you wanted to.
Yeah,
you got choice. You know. So, but there's, you know, billions of people that don't have some food to eat, decent food, place to stay, water to drink, hot water, peace and quiet, you know, or that somebody's chasing them, trying to kill them off because they're the wrong tribe. So we are very, very blessed relative to the scheme of things, relative to so many other people, you know.
We're also blessed that we're nurturing our spirituality, I think.
You cannot nurture your spirituality when your belly is swollen with hunger. It's not possible. You can't do it when you're hungry, and you can't do it when you're in pain. Very difficult. That's why you're encouraged to pursue spirituality when you're young and healthy and vital. When you have your faculties, when your brains are still working pretty well, you know, not when you start to fade and you can't keep it together. I don't wish that on any of you, but there's a lot of people nowadays.
I really think you can program yourself to have all your marbles today.
Yes, I think you can too, but I'm saying there are many people that do not have their marbles as they get older. And we have seen many of them. So that person who may have had a plan to get closer to God later in life, now, you know, it's got Alzheimer's or some other thing, and they don't even know who they're... Yeah, you know. So, take advantage while you can. Condition yourself spiritually. Condition your spiritual behavior at a young age. The younger, the better. You know, my first awakening came at age 19. By age 23, I was so determined and committed to my spiritual growth that I gave everything up and moved into an ashram and lived in an ashram for the next 5 years, from 23 to 28, I was practicing yoga and meditation and various spiritual practices 4 hours every morning from 4 o'clock on. 4 to 8 o'clock, 8 a.m., go have breakfast, and then you go work all day.
Brilliant experience.
It was excellent. getting up at 3 o'clock, but even that becomes a joy after a while.
Yeah.
Once you get used to it.
Hmm? I must do it for a year.
Mm. Oh, yeah. No, just do it for a week. Do it for a month.
Can anyone go?
Well, I mean, even do it on your own, yeah. Or you can
anyone go, like, to the ashram?
Oh, sure. I mean, lots of ashrams. You're more than welcome. The only thing with an ashram is you have to do the program more or less. You know, you have to. You can't just go to an ashram and treat it like a hotel. Yeah.
The thing with ashrams is you're going to have a lot of like-minded people that are really going to help you along as you're doing it, because, you know, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, you're always going to get the sprinklings of people that are trying to escape from the world, and, you know, somehow the ashram just seems to be the place where they like to tuck away. And so you're going to have a mixture of both of those.
Yeah, well, that's inevitable. It's kind of inevitable. All right, so let's do some meditation. Close your eyes, breathe, relax, and let go. Allow the stress, tension, fear, and apprehension to drain from your body. Totally, completely relax. Breathe and let go. High above, a beautiful beam of radiant light comes down, down, all the way down, entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, torso, arms, and legs, out the bottom of your feet, and into the earth below. Breathe, relax, and let go. See and feel yourself by means of this pearl white light connected to the heavens above and grounded in the earth below. Relax. And let go. You are outdoors in a beautiful setting, countryside. Allow that to appear in your mind. No one is around, just nature in all of her beauty. Beautiful day. Notice the trees, flowers, grass, various plants, various kinds of flora and fauna surrounding you. It's perfect. Now, Mother Nature appears personified. She may appear as a woman, an animal, a cow, a goddess, a mother figure, a little girl, whatever form she appears for you. That's the form we want. Allow her to take a form and appear before you. What is her attitude, her disposition, as you greet her? Is she happy? Is she sad? Is she perplexed? Is she in need of help? What? What does she want from you? What would she like you to do on her behalf, on behalf of Mother Nature, or perhaps on behalf of humanity, or on behalf of the animals, or on behalf of the planet? What does she ask of you? Are you willing to do it? Are you willing to help her? Now, she has a gift for you, and she presents you with that gift now. What is it? What does she give you? And what are you to do with this gift? If you have plans to help her, you can meet with her again in a future meditation. For now, thank her for her appearance. Thank her for her many, many gifts and abundance and her beauty. And bid her farewell, and let her fade away. So the meditation ends here. If you're not finished, you may continue. If you are finished, you can return to consciousness. Awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace.